Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, biographer Stacy Schiff takes us inside the secret life of Cleopatra.
She's rather spectacular. And the news, therefore, that she is consorting with Julius Caesar or having a child with Julius Caesar or Mark Antony is major headline news of the day.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Julie Just talks about her 5 years as the children's books editor of the New York Times Book Review.
Some of the things that I was hearing about in 2005 when I came in are suddenly a reality in a way that would have been very hard to anticipate.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. All that after the break.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review podcast is brought to you by Ford, makers of the new Ford Fiesta. With an EPA estimated 40 miles per gallon highway, no other car in its class is more fuel efficient. And by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
Cleopatra, the most famous, the most enigmatic woman who ever lived. She's the subject of a new biography by somebody who actually has the gifts to explain it all. The book is called Cleopatra, A Life. The great author is a Pulitzer Prize winner, Stacy Schiff. The book is reviewed this week for us by Catherine Harrison, who says it's dizzying to contemplate the thicket of prejudices, personalities, and propaganda Schiff penetrated to reconstruct a woman whose style, ambition, and audacity make her a subject worthy of her latest biographer. After all, Stacy Schiff's writing is distinguished by those very same virtues. I'm delighted that Stacy's here to talk about her book. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Sam.
So, look, you're a big prize-winning biographer. You write bestsellers. Everybody knows you're great. But Cleopatra, how do you do? Where do you start with her?
Well, you know, I started with two problems. First, that I was wholly ignorant, as most of us were, about who she was, and I was rather startled that I could be so ignorant about someone who was so powerful and always so present. And then I started on a practical level with essentially what she'd read, because that we could be fairly certain of. So, you know, I put myself on this kind of steady diet of, you know, Homer and Herodotus and Aeschylus and Sophocles and the texts that we knew she and her world would have been familiar with.
How do we know that?
Interestingly, and unknown to me before I started, the classical, so to speak, education among the elite in Cleopatra's day in the first century BC is constant across the board. So if you have a fine Greek education, as would have Julius Caesar or Cicero or Cleopatra, you read the same books. And unlike us, there wasn't a preponderance of books, so you read the same books and there were relatively few books and they were very common texts. So any educated person in the first century BC would have known his Homer backwards and forwards, been able to recite large portions of it. You know, we have school book lessons preserved from kids learning their lines of Homer, learning their lines of Euripides. It's very constant. So the culture is actually very consistent across the board.
How many languages did she speak or read?
According to Plutarch, she speaks 8 languages, which would not have included Greek. So 9 in theory. And the big question mark there is, because he doesn't name it, did she speak Latin? Because the discussion with Caesar and Mark Antony, the two most important Romans in her life, would presumably have been in Greek. But at the end of her life, and when she is in Rome, she would have needed to speak Latin, and that we're not sure of.
She spoke with them in Greek?
Greek would have been the civilized language of the, like, as French was in 19th century diplomacy, Greek would have been the international language of the day. Since we know nothing of her Latin, it was assumed that she would have been speaking Greek.
What other sources did you rely on? Do we really know much about her life at all?
The sources are all of them. There are, I think I counted at one point, 26 original sources, 26 classical sources. The problem is that the earliest of them, and in many ways the most reliable because least biased, is Plutarch. Plutarch is writing many years after the death of Cleopatra. And Plutarch is as far from Cleopatra as we are from Ulysses S. Grant. So if Plutarch is going to tell us a line of Cleopatra's dialogue, do we take it at face value or do we not? And he's really our best source. And from there it spins out to Apion, to Suetonius, it keeps going on and on. But the closest source, and in many ways certainly the most unbiased source, is Plutarch.
So in her own lifetime, how huge a figure was she? I mean, in some sense, as big as she is now?
That's what's great. She is a celebrity in her own day as well, a different kind of celebrity, in that we think of her as, you know, the the shameful seductress, whereas in her day, she's the most powerful ruler. She's among the most powerful rulers in the world, and she is the richest person, man or woman, in the Mediterranean world. So, and moreover, she is, in Egypt anyway, a goddess. So she's rather spectacular. And the news, therefore, that she is consorting with Julius Caesar or having a child with Julius Caesar or Mark Antony is major headline news of the day. I mean, this is not a woman who goes unobserved. I mean, the word of her travels very, very quickly and very loudly.
What was her character like? We've all seen the movies, you know, the vamp of all vamps. But what was she really like as far as you could detect or intuit?
Well, I guess I would answer that with the story of the family history. There are five siblings. When Cleopatra is quite young, the eldest daughter, and when Cleopatra is quite young and the father has left Alexandria momentarily to go to Rome, the eldest daughter attempts to usurp the throne. She is murdered by him on his return. So that's one sibling down. Cleopatra's next. She and her next sibling, her brother, young brother, ascend to the throne on the father's death. She's 18 years old at that point. Within 18 months, they're engaged in a civil war in which he dies. Two siblings left to go. The next younger brother, she is put on the throne with, thanks to Caesar. Not long thereafter, she poisons him. The sister who has challenged her when she rises to the throne, when she's put back on the throne, is exiled to what is now Turkey, and thanks to Mark Antony several years later, she also was killed. So I think what you can say is that you had a pretty strategy-minded, competitive, and rather conniving woman here.
Was she a good leader? Was she a good administrator?
The fact that Egypt, I mean, Egypt is at this point a very, very restive country. There are all kinds of factions. You have a cultural problem in that the elite is Greek and the people who work in the country are Egyptian. Alexandria is a very cosmopolitan city with all kinds of differing interests. During Cleopatra's reign, it is for the most part quiet. There are very few riots. There's very little unrest. The obvious conclusion, unless we're missing something, and we could well be given the scant evidence, is that she rules very, very strongly, very persuasively, and is able to unite the country. And I should have said that among those languages Plutarch lists is Egyptian, and he puts her down as the first of her dynasty even to bother to learn the language of her subjects, which I think, too, would have contributed to her having some sort of hold on that, on her people, and there would have been some sort of loyalty to her, certainly.
And what about the relationships? Shakespeare wrote about them in the most celebrated way with these very powerful Roman leaders. I mean, I'm going to ask the most absurd question. It's going to embarrass me to say it, but because I'm beyond all shame, I'm going to put it this way. Were those meaningful relationships, Stacey?
Could you define meaningful relationships, Sam? I do think it's a little coincidental that she winds up with the two most powerful and celebrated Roman military commanders of the day. I mean, that is kind of a coincidence, right? From the Roman point of view, she's hugely attractive. She controls a vast fortune, and she controls this enormous, enormous quantity of corn, which Rome desperately needs. From her point of view, as Rome is now ascending and extremely powerful militarily, she cannot get by without some kind of literally white knight in the business sense. She needs a benefactor in Rome. Caesar would have been the obvious choice in the year he arrives, and after the next sort of convulsion of Roman civil wars, Mark Antony would have seemed the next obvious choice. So, you know, it's a little bit coincidental. It's also incredibly smart strategically.
Do we know what she looked like?
We know from coins essentially what she looked like, and for better or worse, she looked like her father. She had a hooked nose, a very sharp chin, sunken eyes, a high forehead, not an Elizabeth Taylor lookalike. To a certain extent, you could say, well, she's attempting to look authoritative on these coins. You know, this is a woman who's projecting power and authority. But also, she would have signed off on those coins. She would have had approval on them. So it's certainly the image she meant to convey. All of the busts, all of the paintings we know are, obviously the paintings are, you know, not even to be taken seriously, but the none of the busts can be considered fully accurate. So really the coins are the one thing we have to go on. And given those images and given what Plutarch and Dio have to say about her, the attraction was her facility with language, her charisma, the seductive voice, the reasoning, the charm. It was all about the charm and the intelligence rather than the looks.
How old was she when she died?
39.
Thanks a lot, Stacey.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Stacey Schiff, whose new book, Cleopatra, A Life, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review podcast is brought to you by Ford, makers of the new 2011 Ford Fiesta. With an EPA estimated 40 miles per gallon highway, no other car in its class is more fuel efficient. Besides fuel efficiency, the new Fiesta delivers a ride that's responsive and energized, and it offers special features like push-button start and leather-trimmed seats. Fuel efficiency, performance, new aesthetics, and special features are some of the reasons you'll want to consider the new 2011 Ford Fiesta. Ford invites you to drive one at a dealer near you.
Julie Bosman is here with notes from the field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So the Chilean miners are back in the news.
They are. We have a very interesting book deal this morning announced by Putnam. They have bought the North American rights to 33 Men, which we believe is the first book that will be published in the United States on the ordeal of the Chilean miners.
Who's the author?
The author is Jonathan Franklin, who is an American journalist who has lived in Chile for 15 years, but writes for The Guardian in the UK.
If I remember, he was covering this very closely. Is this his story in some sense? Is that why this book was coveted?
He definitely planted his flag very early. He was paying attention to this story early in August when no one outside of Chile was really paying much attention to it. He lived for a month on the Chilean hillside that was the site of the rescue operation, and he says that he was the first reporter who had access to the families after the miners were finally rescued. And this book is the product of about 75 interviews with rescue workers, with families, and with the miners themselves.
So this is a case, then, where a reporter very closely following the case has really got almost all the work done, so it can be published fairly quickly and still be authoritative?
Yes. Putnam seems to be crashing the book. They're trying to get the hardcover out by February, and the paperback will be coming out a year later. So it'll be done very quickly. I imagine 95% of his reporting and research is already done. So this is a very quick turnaround.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Coming up, Julie Just looks back on her 5 years as the children's books editor of the New York Times Book Review.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review podcast is brought to you by Audible, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Half Empty by David Rakoff. With what Publishers Weekly calls his signature and singular charm, Rakoff uses his third collection of witty, sardonic essays to analyze everything from the hopes and dreams of Hollywood to the broken hearts of childhood. That's Half Empty by David Rakoff, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
An era is ending at the New York Times Book Review. The peerless Julie Just, who's been our children's books editor for 5 years, is moving onward and upward. She's going to become a power in the publishing industry. And now she's here to talk about her experiences as editor of the children's section. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you, Sam.
So you started in 2005, almost exactly 5 years ago. How different do things look now from when you started? Has the world of children's literature changed in that period?
It really is just incredible because when you think about it, let's see, the iPhone comes in 2007. The iPad comes in just this spring. Now, just this week, 2 days ago, we now have the Color Nook, the Barnes & Noble e-reader. And I think these are just enormous changes for children's books, enormous opportunities. But some of the things that I was hearing about in 2005 when I came in are suddenly a reality in a way that would have been very hard to anticipate.
Julie, one of the special qualities of this job, one that sets it apart from others, is to some extent you are an ally of teachers and parents and librarians. They're part of the world you cover. How are they reacting to these changes in books? Are they being overtaken by events more quickly than they can adjust to, or are moms just having their kids read on iPads and iPhones?
You know, I would say really the cutting edge of the response is the librarians. I have yet to meet a librarian who is worried about e-readers, as not embraced the iPad, for example, as a tool for introducing kids to books. Obviously, as a research tool, it's fantastic. But I think on the at least the people I've met, and by the way, they're really in information services now. I mean, that's often a term that you hear. They feel that the possibilities are tremendous for drawing kids into the library, for keeping them engaged. It's been very interesting to me that they're not worried that the physical book will be displaced. And I think maybe that's because they're seeing that it's not, that the two things can coexist.
Julie, one of the important things you do each year is to organize our best illustrated competition, really, where we choose the finest, most beautifully illustrated books of the year. How will something like that be affected by these technological changes? The art, the quality of publication and production, are those values that are going to disappear from publishing?
I think what you're going to see is, I wouldn't call it a backlash exactly, but there's, for example, there's something called the book arts movement, which is, it's kind of a grassrootsy thing going on among the graphic novel community, for example, an emphasis on the handmade book, the values of paper design. Some of the books I've seen on, I've seen them online, of course. I haven't seen them in the paper version. They're like sculptures. You know, they're triangles unfolding. They're very handmade. I don't know if there's a possibility to mass produce them, but there's a lot of emphasis on the paper book as an object.
Shades of John Ruskin and William Morris or something is almost a kind of, you know, the age of the artifact and
well, yes. I mean, you see the book was invented in, what, the first century B.C.? AD, the codex. There are pictures of the book on the walls of Pompeii, you know, and it remains a superior technology in a lot of ways. It's extremely easy to use. It's very portable. The paper book is not going anywhere. I'm not worried about it.
Julie, you have two daughters. How old?
8 and 12.
They are then in that very important category of middle grade readers. And we talk a lot about young adult literature and then about picture books. But you've told me the most important category is actually this middle one. Why is that?
I think in some ways that's true. And actually the greatest pleasure for me in this job is, I mean, something that the writers that came along after I was out of college, so I just didn't know about them. Writers we've talked about like Lois Lowry, also people like Christopher Paul Curtis, and then, of course, Harry Potter. These are amazing stories, very, very rich stories, very rich characters. And this is what's, in general, going to really convert kids to reading, I think. Great picture books will start them out, but it's the chapter books, the series books. These are the conversion books.
And what about young adult fiction? You introduced that as a separate category to our coverage. It had not been done before. How has that changed just in this five-year period? Has it become even more central to the broader culture than it was when you began?
It would appear so, because I read just the other day that I think it remains the fastest-growing category, for example, at Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble is now breaking out different sections of YA fiction. I think you see many different categories there. There's some absolutely beautiful literary novels that are done every year, and there are adult authors still getting into the field. So you have, you know, Nick Hornby and Shimmer Alexie and Jane Smiley, and so many books of real sophistication, and then authors who've only done YA fiction. One of the more interesting factors there is the crossover book. I mean, as Pamela Paul wrote in our pages a couple of months ago beautifully about the attraction for sophisticated readers of this kind of fiction. It's the story. It's and right after that, it's the characters. There's just a strength to that form that has been very impressive to me.
Do you ever hear from kids?
I do. I get letters and emails from them. Often they want to contribute or they want to direct me to their blog. We do, and I understand that kids do read this section too. And I had to be conscious of that in breaking out the YA books and some of the topics that are covered. I began to see not just 14 and up books, but 16 and up books, which tends to mean sex. So that was always a bit of a concern for me, is what the New York Times could cover in the book review. that might be between the pages of a book but might be hard to review.
Well, and what about parents? How do you help them make those decisions about what's appropriate for a child? Or is that not your task at all?
I think parents are one of the main audiences of the children's section of the book review. I've always assumed that. I've always had that sense from the mail I get. But I think the core of the section, the main idea is to present the best of what's out there. And I gather people take the section into the bookstore, so it does work that way.
Now tell us what you're going on to do next.
I'm going to a literary agency, Janklow and Nesbitt, which has never or has done very little young adult and children's books before, and wanted to have someone come in and just concentrate on that.
Congratulations, and we'll miss you.
I'll miss you too. Thank you.
That was Julie Just, who will soon be leaving the New York Times Book Review after having been our children's books editor for 5 years. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
We've got new titles on top of both the fiction and nonfiction lists. Surprise, surprise, Keith Richards tops nonfiction with his memoir, Life, getting great reviews, including on our cover this week, a rave review from Liz Phair, who knows from being a rock star of a somewhat different kind. The book has been generating lots of great reviews and lots of headlines. People were paying a lot of attention to Keith's digs at Mick Jagger for his sort of social climbing.
He calls him Brenda.
Yes. Well, as it turns out, you know, Sir Mick is not the only Rolling Stone who has been sinking into a slough of respectability. In the sort of publicity run-up to the book, it was reported that one of Keith's earliest ambitions was to be a librarian. He's a big collector of books, and at one point he even considered seeking professional training in the Dewey Decimal System so he could tend his library. And as it happened, his American tour in support of this book had one live event at the New York Public Library. So this guy isn't exactly hanging around in seedy bars anymore.
It's so disappointing.
Yeah, well, what can you do?
What else? What else have we got?
Well, number two, another new book, Glenn Beck, is back with a book called Broke. Guess what? It's an attack on Barack Obama. And he managed to knock Jon Stewart down to number three. And I heard some rumors that Jon Stewart was going to hold a rally to restore sanity to the bestseller list outside the Times building tomorrow. So you might want to stay home, Sam.
So we have a result that seems to mirror the election.
Exactly. The bestseller list. The conservatives swept the midterms and they're sweeping the bestseller list. Not just Beck. We've got Condoleezza Rice at number six with Extraordinary Ordinary People. Bill O'Reilly at number seven with Pinheads and Patriots. Michael Savage, the radio host, at number 10 with Trickle Up Poverty. I don't see a lot of liberals on the list, unless you count maybe Stephen Sondheim. He's at number 11 with his memoir, Finishing the Hat.
What about the fiction list?
John Grisham, back with a new book. It's called Confession. It enters at number one. It's about a man who committed a terrible crime but let somebody else go to the chair for it and now is trying to right that wrong. He knocks Lee Child down to number two. And Jonathan Franzen is sort of inching back up the list. He's at number nine this week after falling to number 10. And there's another literary title that's doing quite well. Emma Donoghue's novel Room is back on the list at number 15. It is its sixth week on the list, which is not bad at all for a quite literary novel by a little-known writer, although she's got a long way to go before she catches up with that other Cinderella of the list, Catherine Stockett. Her novel The Help is at number 12 in its 83rd week. I'm really curious to see how long this thing is going to hang on, although I might not live that long.
I was on the train going home to Westchester, where I live. Two women, strangers to one another, on opposite sides of the aisle, were each reading it on Kindles, that book, and I had a conversation when they left the train.
Well, sisterhood is powerful, Sam.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.